people instead of 45 people. And so if you're able to help tomorrow morning, just let me know that. And that way I don't have to go. A little bit of honesty slipped out there. But just, you know, if you're able to help, that'd be fantastic. So that's tomorrow morning. We get there about 8:30. About 8:30 at the community center. That's where we go. These are actually from British newspapers, what I'm getting ready to share with you. And the British are notorious for understatement. That's what makes these humorous. All right? So this is not somebody made up. This was actually in newspapers. Okay. The first one, commenting on a complaint from Mr. Arthur Purdy about a large gas bill, a spokesman of the Northwest West Gas said, "We agree that it was rather high for this time of the year. It's possible Mr. Purdy has been charged for the gas used to blow up his house." The Daily Telegraph. Irish police are being handicapped in a search for a stolen van because they cannot issue a description. It is a special branch vehicle, and they don't want the public to know what it looks like. This is from The Guardian. A young girl who was blown out to sea on a set of inflatable teeth was rescued by a man on an inflatable lobster. A Coast Guard spokesman commented, "This sort of thing is all too common." Like, oh my goodness. From the Times. At the height of the gale, the harbor master radioed the Coast Guard and asked him to estimate the wind speed. He replied that he was sorry, but he did not have a gauge. However, if it was any help, the wind had just blown his Land Rover off a cliff. Aberdeen Evening Express. Mrs. Irene Graham of Thorpe Avenue delighted the audience with her reminiscence of a German prisoner of war who was sent each week to do her gardening. He was repatriated at the end of 1945. She recalled, "He seemed like a nice and friendly chap, but when the crocuses came up in the middle of our lawn in February, they spelled Heil Hitler." Tenth chapter of Matthew, if you'd like to find your way there, please. We're in the middle of the chapter. So as we get underway, we need to kind of go back a little bit and understand where we are in this chapter. In beginning with verse 16 and going through verse 25, now we looked at that last time. This is a section where Jesus begins talking about to his disciples about the persecution that they could expect. He tells them that he's going to send them out, and they're like sheep in the midst of wolves, and they may be as wise as serpents, as innocent as doves. "Beware of men, for they will," verse 17, "deliver you over to the courts and flog you in their synagogues, and you'll be dragged before kings and governors, etc." And then we dealt with that part, and the reason I'm going back to that, because you need that to understand what's coming now. In verse 26, that's where we left off. "So have no fear of them." Of whom? Well, the persecutors that he's been mentioning just from the last number of verses. "For nothing is covered that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be made known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light. And what you hear in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body, but who cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell." Okay? So we'll just park right there for a moment. You're going to face opposition. You're going to face persecution. People within your own household might be your enemy because of Christ. And then he begins here to reassure, don't have any fear. Don't fear them. Because it is limited what they can actually do. Now, it may sound pretty extreme to us, but Jesus points out, you know, do not fear those who can kill the body, but who cannot kill the soul. That there can actually be a threat against your life in persecution. And if you're familiar with church history, you are aware of the early martyrs. And there were numerous early martyrs. You can read in Fox's Book of Martyrs if you want to read about ancient martyrs there. There's some very notorious ones or well-known ones that are mentioned who actually lost their lives. There were others. Persecution in the Roman period, which extends up to up to Constantine, you know, about 400 years there. There was a lot of very intense persecution, but it happened in spurts, and it wasn't necessarily located everywhere at the same time. Sometimes we get the idea that it was, but there were periods of relative peace. The Roman government at first was not necessarily out after Christians. The Jews were. Jewish people did, the Jews did persecute Christians, especially Jewish Christians. You'll find that being put out of the synagogue and that kind of thing. So they did suffer a great deal. But it wasn't later until in Roman period, really when you get to the time of Nero, that's when you begin seeing a pocket of persecution, especially in Rome. You're probably familiar with the history there, that there was a kind of a slum area that Nero wanted to clear. And he wanted to build some, you know, build a palace and all kinds of stuff for himself there. And at least as rumor would have it, he was responsible, or he paid someone to kind of run the people out and burn it out. Well, it got out of hand. And then when suspicion began coming back and laying and being placed at Nero's door, he had to find a scapegoat, someone to blame. Here are these Christian people. They talk about judgment. They talk about fire and hell. So it was an easy shift for him, and he began focusing on Christians. And he did some very horrendous things. Some of the most horrendous, of course, but not just the fighting the wild animals, though that was pretty horrendous. But he actually had Christians put on posts or stakes, held up and covered with tar and set on fire to serve as lights at night, like a lamppost. He had those kind of things. So he's notoriously cruel. He was insane. Most anyone would look at Nero and say the man was probably insane. That was the one that Paul had appealed to, was Nero. When you look at the book of Acts, Paul is on his way to Rome. While he's going to Rome, he's doing so. But he's going to appear before Caesar. That was Nero. And it's kind of interesting. I'm going to use a little bit of, I don't have historical background for this. I'm just making some assumptions on my part. Paul was very, very quick, as it were, to when he appeared before any Roman authority, he gave his testimony. And even before Agrippa and Festus and Felix, he didn't hold really anything back. He was very courteous, spoke very respectfully, but he told them what happened to him and who Christ was. And he even got to the place of before the king, Agrippa. He was talking about judgment and self-control and those kind of things. Now, undoubtedly, Paul did the same thing before Nero. The case against Paul was incredibly weak and really, to the Romans, inconsequential. They didn't care at this point. However, he's a Roman citizen. So he's not going to be mistreated. He uses his Roman citizenship to go all the way to Rome. Now, here's just kind of filling in the gaps a little bit, and I don't know if this is the way it happened or not. But when Paul probably appeared before Nero. He probably did the same thing he did before Festus and Agrippa, and gave his testimony and the significance of that. And it was seemingly, it was sometime after that, that Nero really did went off the deep end. He really did. He began manifesting all these characteristics of someone who had serious mental issues. And, of course, you know, he ended up committing suicide and that kind of thing. So that was kind of going on in that period of time. So later in history, there would be other pockets of persecution, but not necessarily widespread. Sometimes we think it was. Now, having said that, I'm sure you've heard this before because I've said it on other occasions, that more people died during the 20th century for being Christian than people who died in the previous 19 centuries put together. That may be surprising to you. You may think that all the Christians is an ancient world that suffered. That's not the case. More Christians have died in the 20th century than in the previous 19 centuries combined. That gives you something of the scope of what we're talking about with Christian persecution. Jesus warned that persecution was going to be something that was going to happen. And he's going to talk about for my name's sake as we get a little bit further into the chapter. Shouldn't surprise us. But it seems like it does shock us that when we start seeing things that would begin indicating that perhaps persecution, at least on some capacity, is kind of coming down the pike, so to speak. There's already Christians that have experienced this. And it's quite interesting that it's okay to persecute Christians, but they leave certain other groups unmolested. There, you know, you may be familiar with Jack Phillips, the man who makes cakes. He declined to make a cake for a same-sex wedding. But he referred the couple to a baker that would make it. Now, does that sound like a problem? It was a violation of conscience for Jack Phillips to make a wedding cake to celebrate something he just could not believe in. You wouldn't think that'd be an issue. Well, he's been in court for over 10 years. He goes all the way to the Supreme Court, wins there, comes back, and the Colorado court system indicts him again for that very same thing. Someone did a kind of a creative underground kind of thing. They went to Colorado, they went to a couple of Muslim-owned bakeries and asked them to make a same-sex wedding cake. And got them on film saying, we will not do that. Mm-hmm. Anything ever become of that? No. Again, not trying to overstate here, but it's kind of unique to me. I've listened to someone like atheist Richard Dawkins blast Christianity, but he, for some reason, keeps his mouth shut against it about Islam. And you know why, don't you? Yeah, you should know why. Christians pray for their enemies. Muslims cut their heads off. And I'm not overstating that. That is in the Quran. So I'm not making, that's not an overstatement on my part. That's the way it is. So we need to expect it. Not that we look for it or want to embrace it, but it can come. It's already changing. It's already changing. Some of the things that I say to you in here, You know, you probably have no problem with, you probably in full agreement with, but in certain contexts, saying the same things would absolutely get me in really, really deep trouble. I told you the story before about the church sign, didn't I? Some of you. It shows you how naive I can be at times. There was a sign. A saying on the sign. This is the saying. Turn right and go straight. That made perfect sense to me. It did. And then, I can tell you, it was a Thursday afternoon. At that time, the office was closed on Thursday afternoons. I was the only one here. I answered the phone. A fellow that was calling was an editor of a of a gay magazine in St. Louis. I don't know what it, I forgot what it was called. It wasn't something I was readily familiar with. And he said, now, people have been sending me pictures of your church sign all week. What does you mean by that? I said, what? What are you talking about? And I still couldn't put it together. And he said, well, you know, turn right and go straight. I explained it to him. He said, oh, okay. And he was really courteous. He wasn't looking for a fight or anything like that. But what surprised me more than his call, believe it or not, was the number of people apparently here in Salem taking pictures of the sign. Surprised me. Again, I tell you, sometimes I'm pretty naive. At least I was more then. He goes on. Verse 29. Are not two sparrows sowed for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. And again, reemphasizing again, fear not, therefore. You are more value than many sparrows. Okay? Again, we're going to back up in that moment. There's a reassurance that God is not going to abandon His people in the midst of persecution, in the midst of mistreatment. However, if you're the one in the midst of it, it may seem like at times that God has abandoned, but He's promising He won't. Comments about these verses so far before we look at verse 32 and 33. All minds clear? Yes.
In verse 28, latter part, rather than fear Him, who can destroy both body and soul in hell, or soul and body in hell? Are they both going to be destroyed?
Well,
is that what that's talking about, or is that a...
It's your understanding of the word destroy. If we just had this one verse, this portion of the verse here, if that's all we had, it would seem to indicate, okay, we're talking about literally destroying both body and soul in hell. But fortunately, to help us understand it, that's not the only verse we have. We have other passages that use the word, depending on what translation you're using, it'll either be rendered as eternal or everlasting. Okay? That word, that adjective, is used to refer to both heaven and hell. It's aionios. It means eternal or everlasting. And it refers to both. So if we say with some that hell destroys those that are there, how could that be eternal? And when you use the same word to refer to heaven, you kind of introduce a very hard concept to try to work through. How can one mean life eternal and the other mean a cessation of life? Now, I will acknowledge that there are some... A British scholar that I... has several books that he wrote, very good in many respects. In his latter years, he adopted a perspective called annihilationism. And his name was John Stott. And what annihilationism is, it's the belief that those who are sent to hell are annihilated. They're just rubbed out of existence. And it's mainly because of a uncomfortableness with the idea of someone being in hell, as it's described, for all eternity. So it's a response to that kind of that thought, that it seems to be more loving. And they'll use a verse like this to support that particular doctrinal position. Really, though, you can't. If you're consistent, you can't really conclude that. And because the idea of destroy, that may be more of a metaphor than a literal destruction. I hope that helps. And the word that's used for hell there is the one that's most common in the Gospels, and that is Gehenna. To us, we say the word hell, and we have a concept of it. To the Jew of this particular period of history, if you said the word Gehenna, they didn't have simply a mental picture that they would draw of it. They had a literal place. They understood exactly what that meant. Matter of fact, today in Jerusalem, Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, is a park. A beautiful park, actually. But in Jesus' day, it was not. It was a dump. It's where, in the descriptions you find Jesus referring to it, make very good sense. If you had refuse, garbage, you'd take it to the Valley of Hinnom, and that's where you dumped it. Dead animals would be taken to the Valley of Hinnom and their carcasses thrown in there. Sometimes even indigent people, their bodies that no one was around to care for them or to properly bury them, would take them and toss them into Gehenna. And the description of it is it's on fire, and the worm doesn't die, and the fire is not quenched. And it's a very, very bad place. It's bad for another reason, too. During the reign of ancient Israel's, or Judah's, longest reigning king, his name was Manasseh, in the Valley of Hinnom, he brought in and sanctioned and supported the worship of Molech, the god called Molech. And they actually used the Valley of Hinnom as a place of child sacrifice. There's that figure of speech, that idiom that's used in the Old Testament many places, you will not make your children pass through the fire. That's not walking through coals. That's being sacrificed. The Jews were strictly prohibited from practicing human sacrifice. But Manasseh brought human sacrifice right into Jerusalem. And the reason why it became a dump is when you start throwing refuse and sewage and dead animals and that kind of thing into an area, you contaminate it so it cannot be used for any religious purposes at all. So that was purposeful. So when he used the word Gehenna, they knew exactly what he meant. They knew exactly what he meant because they had a mental picture of what he was talking about. So that's a good observation. Yes?
I'm so struck by this, the context of the two sparrows and not falling to the ground without the Father knowing and the hairs on your head number. I've read past those 100,000 times, or at least 100 in my life, and never seen the context in the midst of this persecution and hard things that are going on. And they're not wrong, pulled out, because he does care that much, but I never saw it in the middle of this, the way it is. It's sandwiched in between that.
Right.
And I'm both struck and comforted by that.
And you know, if I can make a parallel to the Apostle Paul, he was persecuting Christians, but prior to his conversion. You know, no question about that. And but when he met Jesus on the road to Damascus, Jesus didn't, the indictment wasn't, you're persecuting the church. You're persecuting me. That Jesus is involved in this. He's there in the midst of this. And the comforting part is, you're not alone. You're not alone. You may feel alone, and you'll be surprised how many, if you get into a situation where you are the object of persecution because of what you believe and your relationship with Christ, there will be a kind of a great divide around you. Christian friends will distance themselves. That's just what happens. And in some of the periods of persecution, there was the practice, and you almost see some parallels with this practice into the book of Revelation that's still yet future. But what it was is there was a loyalty test to Caesar that the citizens of the empire were supposed to annually affirm. And what it was, you didn't have to be in Rome for this to be something that you had to do. Any Roman area, any Roman city, you're required to do this. There was a day of the year called the Day of Roma, where you were to actually go before, there'd be a place there for you to go, and there would be either a statue of or a bust, you know, a head and shoulders of Caesar. And what you were to do, there was an incense altar right there in front of it or by it, and you were to take a pinch of incense, and you were to drop the incense on the coals. While doing that, you were to say, Caesar is Lord. And all you had to do, it was a loyalty test. Now, Christians struggled with that. Because if you didn't do that, you might lose your business. You might lose your home. It wasn't to the point of losing your life yet, but you would be persecuted if you did not do that. Because it was seemingly, if you were failed to do that, you were not loyal to the empire or to Caesar. So Christians would really struggle with that, and there were kind of several positions that developed. One was, I will not say it. I will not do it. Those Christians, they suffered. Others says, hey, listen, it's just words. Just words. I don't believe it. Caesar's not my Lord, but just to, you know, pacify the magistrate, I'll just say it and go about my business. But I'm still serving Christ. And there was that disparity between the two, because the one group said, you're not a genuine Christian if you say Caesar is Lord. And others said, well, I don't mean the words anyway, so it doesn't matter. So that became a very source of contention even among Christians of that era. But what do you do when you're forced to do something? Now listen, when you're forced to do something against your will, but you're forced to do it anyway, what do you do? You know, it gets pretty technical, doesn't it? Or kind of serious. Because that forcing you to do something against your will in some occupations right now is really a real deal. There are some medical schools, apparently, that are either requiring or they're talking about requiring that all of their physicians be trained to do abortions. Or you do not graduate from medical school. And even the current administration has tried to force doctors to perform these trans surgeries. You know, if you're going to receive or, you know, any kind of government monies, you've got to do this. You know, you're the hospital that you're in or working there, you've got to be willing to do these kind of surgeries. So the power of the state is becoming more and more antithetical to Christian practices and belief. Just know that. And so that's you can kind of see where this is going. If you're a physician, you could lose your license or lose your ability to practice medicine if you don't capitulate. If you do not say, okay, I'll go along with it. What do you do? What do you do? Some would say, like the early Christians had to battle this out. Some said, well, you know, don't want to. I'm not going to do this for a living, but I'll have to learn to do it. Others said, I will not do it. It's against my conscience to do such a thing. I will not do it. And I say, okay, you will not practice. Those kind of things are serious. And even though so far, and this is, you know, this is why Christians should be involved in politics. Not hiding from it, but actually be involved in it. When you may remember when the idea of same-sex marriage, for example, was being kicked around. First it was civil ceremonies, and then it moved to actually full-fledged same-sex marriages. The promise from the left always have to abide by this. Okay? Now, to show you how devious that statement is, it does not affect you in your everyday life. It means that I can say I will not perform a same-sex marriage, and I'm okay. But your life, it doesn't apply to you. But it doesn't apply to you. If you're a Christian baker, it doesn't cover you. If you're a business owner, it doesn't cover you. If some man shows up dressed like a woman, and you can say, by the way, the door is right over there. It doesn't apply to you, you see. I don't know if you were aware of that or not. But that's just political doublespeak. It's just devious that they would do such a thing. So what I'm saying by all that, what Jesus is saying here is relevant. Point is, he is with it. He's there with you. He will not abandon you. Even Paul said that. Everyone's abandoned me, but the Lord stood by me. Remember? Okay. Let's look at the next two verses. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge before my Father who's in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny him before my Father who's in heaven. Do you see how that works together? So what are you going to do? Are you going to deny him by simply saying, well, it's just words? Or are you going to stand for what you believe? Jesus is encouraging his followers to stand and not just compromise with the culture that is pushing them in a different direction. Well, then they should be. That's what he's talking about there. If you're ashamed of me before men, I'll be ashamed of you before my Father who's in heaven. Underscoring the seriousness of that particular thing. And back to the day of Roma. It really, the words didn't sound that much different because most people spoke Koine Greek. And what you were supposed to do when you took a pinch of incense and drop it in there, you were supposed to say, Kurios Kaiser, Lord Caesar. But what Christians often would do, they wouldn't drop the incense in, but when it came to the profession, they'd say, Kurios Christos. Christ is Lord. And those words were treason. Those words were treason. And anyway, so any questions there or comments or observations before we move to the next paragraph? You know, just the pressure... To show you this, in some universities, especially secular universities or government-funded schools, the pressure is enormous on the teachers, faculty, professors to capitulate. I was talking to somebody on the phone today. It was a health insurance thing. And she asked me this. Now, what are your preferred pronouns? Now, if I knew that question was coming, I would have had a real snide answer. But I didn't know. I said, just masculine, you know, he, his, that, you know, that kind of thing. And she says, I'm required to ask. You know, but I don't know. Some of those, you can really come up with real creative ones, you know. But I can't think that quickly. But I've read this a long ago about a professor that was actually fired because he used the wrong pronoun. Fired, or denied, and others denied tenure because of not using preferred pronouns. I got a book for you to read if you want to read it. It's written by Everett Piper. He was a president of a Christian university in Oklahoma City, I think. Not one of the Oral Roberts or anything like that. It was a more biblically sound one. And anyway, during a chapel service, a student complained that the speaker during that chapel service made him feel uncomfortable. He was describing what love actually was, I think from, I want to say 1 Corinthians 13. Anyway, Piper was told about the complaint. And he wrote an article that went viral that later became a book. And it said, talking about college, this is not a daycare. And it just resonated with so many people. Everett Piper, this is not a daycare. If you ever want to read something that's quite amusing, if it wasn't so serious. Okay? All right, 34. Do not think that I have come to bring peace on the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. Now, isn't that a statement? I thought Jesus was, all he talked about was love. I thought Jesus, all he talked about was that we should get along and care about each other and forgiveness and all that. Yeah, but he also said that. If you got a red letter Bible, it's red letter. You notice that? That means he's speaking. Do not think I have come to bring peace on the earth, but I brought a sword. I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies will be those of his own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Now those words you may have heard many times. And if you've been in church a long time, I'm sure you have. I'm sure you've read it. If you invite your daily Bible reading or you're reading through the Bible in a year, you've read these words. Do you feel the force of what he's saying? This is forceful. As a matter of fact, it kind of freaks people out. Now, in another context, he's going to say something very similar, but he's going to use the word hate. And I'm like, wait a minute, Jesus. But for us right now, let's just stick with these. Whoever loves his father and his mother more than me is not worthy of me. Aren't you supposed to honor your father and your mother? Yeah, you are. Commanded to, by the way. But here he's pointing out that if he doesn't take the second place, he's first. Now, how can he say that? Because he is first. That's why. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever, he goes a bit further. And verse 38. And whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Now, anybody got any jewelry on? Not men. But any ladies got, you got a cross on or anything? It's a very popular piece of, it's been popular for eons, you know, just a cross that you might wear, earrings, necklaces, whatever. But they didn't think about it. When they used the word cross, they didn't think anything like that. They didn't think about something on top of a church steeple. Or somewhere else positioned in a Christian church where that cross is a very important symbol. They didn't think of it that way. They didn't even really think of it as a symbol. When his disciples heard him say this, they thought of one thing, and that's a cross that a man is going to be nailed to. And a place where he's going to die in a very, very horrific way. That's what they thought of. And it's interesting, too. Let's look at what's... You into pronouns? Well, you will with this one, okay? Whoever does not take up his cross. Not Jesus' cross. Isn't there a song, we let Jesus not bear the cross alone? Mm-hmm. That's not the point here. The point here is you have one. But what is it? I mean, what is it? If you and I could be transported back to the first century, and we were just out somewhere in Jerusalem, and we were watching people, maybe be condemned men going to the place of execution, they're at least carrying the crossbar, you know, of the cross. They could even be already nailed to it, so they won't drop it. At least they're tied to it, and they're carrying it to that place where it's going to be attached to the vertical part. They're carrying the horizontal bar or beam. When you saw someone doing that, you knew where they were going. They were going to the place of their death. Now, what kind of things, kind of enter into the discussion with me here, what kind of things do you think a man, because they really didn't crucify women, but a man carrying that crossbar going to the place of his crucifixion, what do you think, what thoughts are on his mind? Do you think about retirement or where he's going on vacation?
What's coming
next? His mind's pretty well singular. And notice that's the thing that would be very real here in the minds of the people listening. And whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Now, people are not executed on crosses in our nation. There's still a few executions taking place, but can you imagine if we had transposed that to our day, we'd say something like, take up your lethal injection and follow me. Take up your, even though probably not used much anymore, your electric chair and follow me. Take up your noose and follow me. You get the dramatic part of it. You're going to a place of death. And the cross is not anyone else's. It's yours. So, it's just kind of an interesting little side note there. And then in verse 39, whoever finds his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For lack of a better expression, you'll find in the Gospels what I said to refer to as the great reversal. What you think is up is really down. And what you think is down is really up. If you ever look at Philippians chapter 2, that great Christological hymn there, if you notice there, it is a series of demotions. Not promotions, but demotions until you get down to verse what? Is it 9 and 11? That every knee will bow and every tongue will confess to the glory of God. It looks like Jesus is a downward spiral. He became, even though he was equal with God, he did not see that as a thing to be grasped or held on to. But he humbled himself, became obedient, taking on the form of a servant, and even dying on a cross. You know, that kind of thing. And you find that at the bottom, he's exalted. And what we sometimes fail to realize is that in God's economy, and I don't mean that money-wise, just in God's economy, God's way of doing things, his kingdom, the greatest are the least. The most important are the servants. And it's just mind-boggling because everything around us is set up the opposite direction. Those at the top have the servants serving them. And Jesus turns that upside down and said, no, it's the other way. Those who find their life will lose it. And those who loses his life, now, there's a qualifying words here, for my sake, will find it. We'll find it. One of the most dramatic passages illustrating this is John 13, where Jesus washes the feet of the disciples. Jesus washes their feet. Why is that dramatic? Because he wasn't supposed to. He wasn't supposed to. I've drawn the little image for you before, but when they were there at that Last Supper table, the person who was the least, or a servant, or a slave, was supposed to wash everybody's feet. They were in the reclining with their feet out away from them on their left side at the meal. And then the one that was supposed to do the foot washing was Peter, because he went all the way around and took the very least position. And I can show you that by demonstrating, by drawing it out, if you want to do that sometime. But anyway, I know that because I know where John was, I know where Jesus was, and I know where Judas was, and I know where Peter was around the table. Those I can identify. But so at a certain point, who's the only disciple that protested the washing of their feet? Peter. Why? It was his job. It was his job. Lord, you're not going to wash my feet. And then Jesus says something really remarkable. And it's not just about foot washing. He said, I'm your Lord and Master, and that's right. But if I have washed your feet, you ought to wash one another's feet. I've given you this as an example. This is what greatness looks like in God's kingdom. So, maybe you've got maybe you're doing a task here in the church. Maybe nobody knows about it. Maybe no one even would even care about it. Is it important? That's not a trick question. Y'all looking at me like, I don't know whether to say yes. Oh, it's very important. It's those menial tasks that no one wants to do that reveals just how great in the kingdom you really are. I remember one of our deacon's wives down in Southeast Arkansas. In Southeast Arkansas, it was the Mid-South. It was kind of like the New South, but it was still the Old South. You may think, well, what are we talking about? People actually trained their dogs to bark at somebody of a different race. And I mean, seriously, I didn't believe it, but you had prejudiced dogs down there. At least when at the time that I lived there. It may be different now. I hope it is. However, one of our deacon's wives, she would help take care of some of the black population that lived down in the Delta. She just took care of people. There was an elderly couple, I used to be able to call their names, and she would just take care of them, and that was rare, and that was odd. That was odd, in a sense that wasn't to be done. But anyway, she did it. But anyway, so let's move on so we can get through this chapter before we lose our time. Verse 40, whoever receives you receives me. And whoever receives me receives him who sent me. You see, he's still with us, right? You see that? Even in the midst, you know, he's talked about persecution. He's talked about these other things, carrying your cross. He's still, whoever receives. And the one who receives a prophet because he is a prophet receives a prophet's reward. And he who receives a righteous person because he's a righteous person will receive a righteous person's reward. And whoever gives one of these little ones even a cup of cold water because he is a disciple, truly I say to you, he will by no means lose his reward. A cup of cold water. Now, what are these little ones? You could also understand that instead of little, but as least ones. What do you think he's talking about?
New convert?
Yeah? Let's back up just a little bit. We've been talking about persecution, right? Jesus has been talking about persecution. What do you do with a brother or sister who's being persecuted? You're there. You're helping. You're concerned. In addition to that, perhaps, you're meeting their need. And maybe more is being implied there than simply a cup of cold water. But you're helping them. You haven't abandoned them. You know, Paul had people helping him, even when he was imprisoned. He was under house, when he got to Rome, he was under house arrest, but his friends could come and go at will. So there can be occasions when that'll be the case, that someone might be being persecuted, imprisoned, because of their faith, that we could continue to support and to help. That's, again, that's not an easy thing. Because you run the risk of also being persecuted for helping someone who is being persecuted. That's why the disciples were so afraid after the crucifixion of Jesus. Could we be next? And the answer is, yeah, you could be. Yeah, you could be. Any questions about this particular chapter that we finished? Or anything prior to it, actually? There's another book you can get a hold of that might be helpful. And it's written by a husband and wife missionary team, and it's called By Their Blood. It talks about martyrs in the 20th century. And at one time there was a contemporary singing group called DC Talk. Probably not the kind of music most of you would look to listen to, but nevertheless, they had some pretty good songs, DC Talk. They did two volumes in conjunction with The Voice of the Martyrs, which is a ministry out of Oklahoma. Very good ministry, by the way. And they did that. I remember my our daughter, our oldest daughter, she was crazy about DC Talk. And I was cool with it, too. The Jesus Freak, I really liked that song. Yeah. Crazy it sounds. I did. I liked it. You never forget about his belly shook like a marmalade jelly or something. But anyway, she wanted that book, so I bought it for her. And I watched her, she was sitting down in the middle of her floor, she opened that up and began reading one of the chapters in it. And I saw the shock. She had no idea what was in that book, even though it had DC Talk on the outside. Mm-hmm. And I saw her just lay it down and kind of look at the back. It was the true stories of martyrs in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So, and if you want to check out more about that, you can go to Voice of the Martyrs. It's just what it's called. It's called Voice of the Martyrs. To be aware of, because they kind of keep their thumb on the pulse of what's going on throughout the world. And you may be surprised that that life and death persecution is happening right this moment. Right this moment. One final story. Years ago, we had we used to call them World Mission Conferences. Where we'd have missionaries, both home missionaries, foreign missionaries, and churches with an association would join together. And we've done that here. We've ferried them around, that kind of thing. We had, it wasn't here, but it was in Tokyo. We had a fella, he was from Vietnam. I called him An Van Pham, but his name was An Van Pham. Literally, that's his name. Great guy. And he was actually a missionary here in the United States, working with Vietnamese, somewhere in Georgia, and he was great. He would talk about what it was like coming to the United States, and he'd talk about the confusion that he had at first. He said, "Why do you drive on a drive? Why do you park on a driveway and drive on a parkway?" I never thought of that before. And then he talked about he was handed a document. At one place to fill it out, the lady said, "Fill this out." And he said, he just looked at her. "I know how to fill it in. How do you fill it out?" And he went through all kinds of things like that that we don't even think about. But let me tell you about An Van Pham, or An Van Pham. When he was about I don't know, 10, 12 years old. The communist executed his dad right in front of him. Mm-hmm. And many of the men that were Christians, these were Christian men, in the village in which he lived in. Can you imagine living with that? Mm-hmm. That image in your mind? It's your dad, who was a leader in the village, but yet he was, you know, still a Christian. Now, he wasn't scarred by it or anything like that. Matter of fact, he was a very balanced man, to be sure. But you know, so sometimes you have to go very far to find someone that understands very vividly what Jesus is talking about here. Very vividly. All right. Next time, chapter 11. And it's this, it's a very... John the Baptist was an individual that you think had it all wired, right? We're going to talk about John's doubt, because he had some. That's next time. All right, stand and stretch.
Pastor, in these last few verses here, does that point to different rewards in heaven?
His country had sent him to West Texas and the State University. to learn how to take 13 acres of land and from the refuge that came out of the animals to fix some kind of a fertilizer that could be used and could, for goats, because they couldn't have cows. It was a cow's too big. They didn't want a cow. But it was fun. You know, those kind of experiences you never forget.
I wonder how much we live up to the things that are in that about taking up the cross and giving your witness.
I always think, though, can you imagine when they had that? That had to be shocking that he would say something. That would just shock your socks off. Take up your cross. I mean, that's just like, what's he?
They understood it. Like you said, yeah.
Probably one of those times where some just decide, I don't think I want to do this anymore. And went away.